come to order. We have a set up. We have set up a meeting for tonight to handle our overflow from today between the Game and Fish as well as environment policy bill from the department. I'm predicting that we will have to go into tonight. We want to make sure we take care of the bills.
Who did that?
We heard last hearing. While people are kind of getting settled, why don't we take Senator Scogin's Senate File 2838? Mr. Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 2838 deals with the 5-mile hike into the woods. You kill the deer. Do you want to take the head with you when you quarter it and carry it out? The current law allows us to quarter that deer for the walk back to your vehicle or to your hunting shack, but it does require that the head stay on. This proposal allows the hunter to take the head off and not have to transport that 7-pound weight back to the hunting shack or the cab.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. This issue has come up within our corporate board and our membership for the last 3 or 4 years. The issue is, as Senator Scogin said, that if you have a large doe and you are decided to quarter your deer and you're hauling your quartered deer out of the woods, hauling a useless deer head, basically, is not something we prefer to do if we can find a way to do that within the constraints of the DNR, which I understand has some slight word changes they'd like to do in regards to being able to judge the gender of the deer without the head. It's really not much more to it than that. I would add that there are certain parts of the state in the Boundary Waters Canoe area, those deer management units, and inside what are described as the ConCon lands that are up in sort of Senator Stump's district and south of Senator Scogin's, that, you know, people go 5, 6, 8 miles back in the woods, and hauling a fully unquartered deer is difficult. And if it's a doe, there seems to be no reason or no desire to bring the head out of the woods as well. Obviously, if it's a trophy deer, it's a different situation.
Do any other states allow this?
I know Canada does for moose, Senator. I don't know about other states. I haven't. Maybe the DNR does. We've allowed quartering of deer, I think, for the last 8 years. I think.
Say that again?
I think we've been allowing for the quartering of deer for the last 6 or 8 years, if my memory serves me right. We're just asking for the ability
to remove the head.
Senator, I do know that the DNR has some concerns, as I said, about judging the gender, and they have, I think, some preferred language there.
Are we becoming softer as a hunting community? How many decades have we been hunting? Hundreds of years have we been hunting deer in this part of the world, and that's why I asked if other states do this, see if we're unique in some way. That's my main question.
Senator, I don't.
We're getting to the point where we should just go to the grocery store. we should just allow people to, you know, bring your gun into a grocery store, pretend you shot it, and then bring it home. It's all nicely quartered, and it's even vacuum sealed, and it's easier.
Senator, I know that the 20,000 deer hunters that I represent really prefer to be out in the woods with their friends and their family hunting deer in the traditional fashion. I don't know when quartering deer was outlawed or not permitted. I would imagine sometime in the late 20s or 30s in this state, you could quarter deer and nobody was caring one way or the other. And then maybe Mr. Meyer or someone else from the DNR knows the rationale for why we first did not permit the quartering of deer. I know that I worked on a law, as I said, I believe 6, 8 years ago, to allow for quartering of deer.
Okay. Well, let's hear from the department.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Our Deer Management Committee has been discussing this issue. We're okay with the language, except we need to deal with the ability to have genitalia attached to one of the quarters to be able to provide for the identification of the sex of the animal. And also our concern is that that evidence must remain with the animal in areas of antler point restrictions. If this law were to go into effect, the 3A, 3B changes that we had last year, we would have no way to enforce it. So that's the only area in the state where antler point restrictions are allowed right now. There's an interest in trying to continue some of the changes that were made for 1 year last year. We're looking at survey results and looking to do that through rule. But we need to be able to identify the genitalia being attached to one of the quarters, and then in areas where antler point restrictions are there, the head of bucks must remain attached. I don't know if Senate Counsel can help us with that language, or I have some suggestions as well.
I thought maybe we could, if members wanted, include this in the overall game and fish bill, and then that would give an opportunity to massage the language. That be all right?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer did try to work this out with me yesterday, and our appointments conflicted all day long, and we never did get to the bottom of it, so that's why he's here with some problems today. But I was aware that there could be some problems with it. This is what some of the other states do, by the way, that allow the head to be removed. They do require the genitalia to be attached to one of the quarters, and as Mr. Kelleher pointed out, the rear quarter would work best for that. Mr.
I actually did have a question about that.
Once we cut everything off, we're not sewing it back on.
Right. I had a question about that because I haven't field-dressed a lot of deer, but the ones that I have dressed, you take everything out. Everything is removed. And I don't know if Mr. Meyer or Mr. Kelleher, you know how, without getting too graphic, how that would be done without sewing it back on.
Mr. Chairman, in a delicate manner, I've been told that it's not difficult, but it's just normally not done. But if you've made the decision to quarter your deer, there is a way to leave
what needs to be left,
thank you, the genitalia of the deer.
You want to be, Mr. Chair, equally as good with the gun and the knife.
Mr. Meyer, do you know if other states allow this for the deer? I know the head, the moose and the elk and caribou.
Mr. Chair, I'm not particularly sure what states do or don't, but it's something we can try to look into and get back to you on. As Mr. Kelleher said, there is a way to do it, and as the bill is drafted, after registration, once that animal is registered, that could be removed as well.
Senator Ingberson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, this appears to be a statewide thing, could be a real enforcement nightmare for you, could it not? Or am I thinking of something wrong here? Are we talking about a certain area of the state? Maybe the senator can address that we should be looking at just doing it a certain part of the state, because we don't need to do that anyplace else, which you wouldn't have to anyhow then.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think, Mr. Chair, that may be true, although I'm always hesitant to pass laws that kind of carve out certain sections of the state, and there's no, even somebody hunting a cornfield in southwestern Minnesota may find it convenient to quarter a deer that they shoot out there maybe a half mile off the road, and maybe our age, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and would just soon not have to carry that whole thing back in one piece.
Wouldn't it be as hard to saw up a deer in the field as it is to drag it out?
No, Mr. Chairman, no, sir. They have very nice little kits, I suppose you'd call them, with saws and all sorts of implements to gut a deer and to quarter it. I don't think it's any more complicated than field dressing a deer, a couple extra steps, so to speak.
And, Mr. Chair, I think especially for the hunters who plan to quarter theirs, they bring that equipment with them.
I guess there is that one thing where you, like with caribou or elk, you can pack it. You're still carrying it out in most situations.
But it's in much more manageable size.
You actually put it in the, maybe even to, into a backpack. In some cases.
Yes.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think we could... we could address one of Mr. Meyer's concerns fairly simply if he has a bill in front of him and could follow what I'm going to suggest.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move on line 8 and 9, reinstate the stricken language, and after head, insert or genitalia.
Mr.
Yeah,
Chair,
I think the intent of the isn't the intent of the bill to strike the requirement that the head remain.
Mr. Chairman, they would have their choice of the
Leaving
the head
or
the genitalia,
one or the other,
but they can't remove both.
Okay, all right, that gets added the same way, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, that gets us halfway there. The other problem we have is dealing in areas where there maybe antler point restrictions in dealing with that, making sure it is a legal buck if it has two antlers or one antler. And just to Senator Ingebrigtsen's point, when we initially discussed this, it was within the BWCA and other remote locations. I had that discussion with Mr. Johnson, and he was comfortable with going to that area if the committee so desired. It would help us with enforcement opportunities and provide the areas of relief that we were looking for. I think that the deer hunters were looking for Boundary Waters Canoe Area. A classic example is the muzzleloader season within Jay Cook State Park, which is very hilly and ravine. Ravenna, there's a lot of ravines there. And we could work on remote areas.
Some of your special hunts are including antler point restrictions, too. Yes. Let's lay this over, and y'all can and work on the language.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's Senate file... 2838 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus game and fish bill. Okay. So shall we?
Where is he? Where was he? Scorbin, where were you? Oh, here.
We continue with yours?
Okay.
Okay.
Now, where were we last time?
So we were at what we were doing is I'm sorry, we left off with we were taking testimony on the two bills. Do you have any more witnesses for your bill?
Mr. Chair, yeah, and just to refresh the chair and committees as to what this bill contains, what we're trying to do here is taking definitions out of 84.02 and, well, that's basically what it does. And should there be any other definitions, and although that's the most important part of my bill, we do have an amendment now that's been offered by Senator Anderson. That would go in Section 97, which is just the DNR and portion of the
just the Outdoor Heritage Council
of a statute.
Mr. Knopf, do you want to clarify?
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify on that last part, the amendment by Senator Anderson puts it in 97.856, so it would only affect the language in the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Outdoor Heritage Council. Would not affect any other DNR programs or any other DNR issues. It would only affect the Outdoor Heritage Fund money.
All right.
So, Mr. Chair, I have no other testimony, okay. And the amendment is before us, I guess.
The our agenda has Mr. Meyer on this as well. Do you want to testify?
Mr. Chair, my comments that I made previously.
All right. All right. That's good. Okay. So then, if it's okay, and because we kind of cut the public off, could we continue with the testimony? And then we will make sure to discuss Senator Anderson's amendment.
That's fine.
I think why don't we take Mr. Cox?
You
here?
He doesn't want to come up.
Oh, he's not. Okay, sorry, Mr. Jess.
Good
Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Tom Jess. I reside in Plymouth. I'm a private citizen. I had some handouts that I had given to your staff to copy and hand out.
We'll pass those out.
What I'm here to testify on is across both Senator Saxog's bill and your bill as well. It has to do with the definitions and also with the legislative guide. What they're handing out is a I've gone through and I've tried going across the internet and doing a lot of late night searches for the words protect, enhance, and restore, and the history of that. It goes back where I could find all the way back to 88, where we started with the constitutional addition for the lottery. And in 91, Governor Carlson issued a no-net loss statement. We had the Minnesota Wetlands Conservation Act passed. In 1999, Governor Ventura kept a bunch of Governor Carlson's executive orders. And then in 2000, he came up with his own no-net loss order, which pretty much about 95% of it was the same as Governor Carlson's. When Governor Pawlenty took office, he issued an executive order bringing across a number of orders so that they did not expire. That included Governor Ventura's no-net loss order. We've got... In 2008, a Minnesota statewide conservation and preservation plan. It's about 400 pages, so I don't want to try and show you how thick it is. But there were some things in there where it worked with those definitions with critical land protection and also with land and water restoration and protection. In 2008, we had the constitutional amendment passed for the 3/8 of 1% addition to the sales tax. Again, the words protect, enhance, and restore were on there. And then in 2009, wetlands restoration strategy, that's a 33-page document, and it lists some of the things that I've included in there. And then at the bottom of page 3, there's a number of definitions. What I'm trying to say here is that we have a history of those definitions of protect, enhance, and restore being used by the agencies to guide their their conservation work throughout the state. There is no reason to change those definitions. In the second document that they're passing out, it's an EPA document that talks about ecological restorations. What that document says is unless you're prepared to make a broad definition of where you are expecting the restoration to be as far as what you're hoping to reproduce, is it, pre-settlement times? Is it, 50 years ago? Is it 10 years ago? What are you hoping to do? It's so nebulous that my personal opinion, we shouldn't even be messing with it. It's just something that if you try and look at those definitions that have been proposed either by the House or I'm sure that Senator Anderson has a redefinition along ecological lines, but with all due respect, why should we change something that's not broken with regards to our conservation practices? And then with regards to the legislative guide, there are too many items within there that don't pertain to habitat restoration. The House, and I'm not sure, and I'm glad that the Senate is taking and making steps to just do away with it, because I voted for the constitutional amendment to protect, enhance, and restore the habitat in the state and to clean up our waters. And I agreed with the Parks and Rec and somewhat with the arts, but it's to protect, enhance, and restore the habitat within the state. It's not to create jobs. If jobs are created as a subset, it shouldn't be a priority to create jobs with that habitat money. And with that, I'll finish my statements. Oh, there is one other thing. And this is how I'm sort of a little bit of a pack rat, so this is out of a 1978 document. Others see the primary safeguard against extensive future loss of wetlands as comprehensible and enforceable state and federal regulations based on the understanding of the importance of wetlands to the aquatic system. This view is based on the principle that society has the responsibility and right to protect water, including wetlands, from destruction and degradation for the common good, and that landowners are not guaranteed the privilege of making a maximum profit from their land if it involves the irreparable loss of a part of the nation's aquatic resources to the detriment of all. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Jess? All right.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jess, I think you make a lot of really good points, and I appreciate the history. It's useful for all of us to review that. I think the last thing you said goes back to what Senator Dill said, that you can protect things in some ways. You just talked about regulation as a way to protect wetlands, and I think that's exactly the point that Senator Dill made, that sometimes there's other ways to protect things. And I think that's really that's all that I'm talking about, is that perhaps we need to be a little more open to some other approaches. But I kind of tend to agree with you. I don't think we don't really, and Senator Saxaug and I have talked about this. I don't know that we really need any definitions. But as long as there are some in the council's documents, there's always going to be some legislators who want to change them. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And so I think we're at a point where, well, I guess I'll stop there.
Senator Olson.
We can debate later.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been trying to reflect on this. It's interesting because we keep repeating the words protect, enhance, and restore. Those words have their meaning. It seems that what's happening is that what it is that we're going to protect, enhance, and restore is what we seem to be meddling with in the change of so-called definitions. This is talking about ecosystems versus the actual, whether it's wetlands or water quality or habitat. Those are specific things. And if to try to say you redefine protect, enhance, and restore, you know, those have general meanings as verbs in action. But it's where we're going to direct the resources that we're going to do those things to or for. And I think that's what there seems to be a shift in with this effort to so-called redefine. And I think we ought to think carefully, because that was quite specific in what people voted on, and I think to betray that is wrong.
Mr. Chair, yes. Committee members, I agree. Now, when you get into the definitions, if you've got the EPA document, that one says that it's very hard to put the, you know, ecological restoration is nice, but how do you define it, and at what level are you going to define it? It leaves it very open-ended, and I think that it also gets to be very expensive, because in reading up on it, you're looking at something that is going to take a lot of management, and I don't know that we're prepared to maybe take on those costs as it goes along the ecological systems lines rather than with the habitat. And it's trying to get the biggest bang for the buck. And if we start messing with something, we better, you know, then we want to take a look at what we've historically done and make sure that we're able to do that versus trying to take on something new and not necessarily know where we're going.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have maybe a concern, or I don't know if it's a question along those same lines with regards to looking at the definitions on the EPA as well here. I mean, how far back are we going to have to go here if we have this in our statute? It seems to me very, actually a little scary. Not that I'm not concerned about the ecosystems, but however, what's the definition going to be, and how long are we going to, I mean, I see real problems here, and I think that's why we discussed this when we were in the Lessard Committee a couple years ago or a year and a half ago, came up with a very basic one, and I'm glad to see the testifiers say that it's been involved in legislation in the past, but I see opening up a box here where we're going to actually sit and spin our wheels and get nothing done if we're going to worry about reestablishment of pre-disturbance aquatic functions. I mean, I think that's a little, I mean, you know, we're just not going to get done what we intended to do and what the folks voted on here, so I would certainly speak against the amendment.
Mr. Bazat. Thank you, Mr. Jess.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Jim Bazat, and I am with the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and my comments will be truly brief. MOHA and its member groups are in strong support of the unchanged Senate file 2830. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. McMillan.
Realize I'm an addendum. Don McMillan, president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I'm actually, if it's appropriate, speaking to the other bill that's before us here. Let's get this straight. 2830, is that okay? Okay. As most of you know, MOHA is an organization made up of many conservation, hunting, and outdoor groups. In Minnesota, we have close to 300,000 constituent members when you add up all of our groups and their members. And MOHA supports the original Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council definitions of protect, enhance, and restore. The changes that were made at the end of the last session last year in 2009 allow for these funds to be used for other purposes as well as supplanting of traditional sources of funding. We also believe that a legislative guide is premature at this time and that we should first complete the 10-year and 25-year plans before we jump ahead to that legislative guide. So basically, I'm testifying in favor of 2830. To go back to the original definitions that came from the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kielash, you had your hand up. Did you have a question for the witness or a question in general?
And yes, I do, and maybe you can address it a little bit. But one of the things that I see in the definitions that came up towards the end of the session was a desire to have a quality standard for these restoration dollars and enhancement dollars. And I'm not sure that it's, I guess asking for more to happen with the dollars. And in some cases, I think the restoration or the enhancement can be brought to those levels without really a lot of additional expenses. And I'm just wondering, is the objection to having to do something a little more or a little better that, you know, Minnesota is not the same state that we walked in, where our ancestors walked into. It's the whole landscape is different. Are we just trying to just buy land and set it aside and not do anything with it, or are we trying to restore it back to some semblance of native conditions so that the wildlife that existed here are, you know, are in a place that they would be familiar with? You know, there's several parts of the state that there's, you know, wildlife species, cat, you know, bobcats, whatever, that are no longer in those places. And I'm just trying to figure out where's the line in that enhancement? Where's the line in that restoration? And isn't that what the definitions are trying to get at?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that's probably a good point that you brought up. And the question is, how far back do we go, probably? I go back in my lifetime, and I'm older than you.
Yes.
And obviously, and I go back to a time probably when I started hunting here in this state in the early 50s. And there was an abundance of ducks. We had a lot of divers coming through Minnesota. We could hardly wait for that that northern flight to come through that we all dreamed about. It was just the culmination of a successful hunting season. And that has all pretty much gone away, you know, for a variety of reasons. We've lost our wetlands, and so I agree with you on that. But, again, how far back do you go? And I think our problem is that sometimes when you get into talking about ecosystems and things like that, you broaden the definition so much that it allows for a certain amount of, I guess I'll use the word mischief, to use the funds for other reasons. So that's what bothers me about it. But I agree with what you're saying, Senator. There's no question that we're trying to bring it back to a certain level. But what that level is probably in the mind of the beholder, you or I, you know.
Well, I think what some of these groups are and what the DNR testified to is that level needs to remain in the eye of the practitioner for and what's appropriate for that particular area and parcel. And when, as the DNR mentioned, highest quality ecological value is a term of art in the conservation community that is narrow and exclusive of the things that broad nature of enhancements that you could put onto a onto the land.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but one of the things that when we talk about restoring a prairie pothole, they've been plowed over for decades. If you restore a prairie pothole, what's the landscape around it going to be? What's the vegetation that's going to be put in place to support that prairie pothole? I think some of the things that we're looking at is trying to look at, here's a standard that not only fits the wildlife restoration part of that, but it also fits in the natural ecosystem of that original environment. I don't see necessarily a conflict there. I just see an enhancement to make sure that the pothole that is developed for waterfall is back up to a standards that it probably was originally when you were hunting it. That's what I'm viewing this as. That's where the resistance.
What they are saying, Senator Kilash.
Yes, can you let him answer, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator, Mr. McMillan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, a good point. We all know that you can't just build a prairie pothole and not worry about what's around it because it's not going to work. And I guess I would have a certain amount of faith in people that are doing these that wouldn't happen. But at the same time, I have no problem with creating certain standards, for example, for restoring prairie potholes. But I suspect they may already be in place somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, I certainly don't know everything about that. But I do know that prairie potholes are an individual thing, and you've got to restore the land around a prairie pothole or you don't have a prairie pothole.
Mr. Chair, that was just one example, but yeah. That may be an extreme example because you're talking from a plowed field essentially to a wildlife area. But I'm looking in terms of similar to that. I'm not sure that the definitions are right, but I certainly hope that we can get definitions that do its best to return Minnesota to a wildlife and natural resource that it was when you were growing up. And that's all I'm at.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we do have many projects that have come through at the request of groups like Ducks Unlimited. And without a doubt, Ducks Unlimited has probably more knowledge than anybody as far as restoring wetlands. So I think those standards are already out there, but I do agree with you that certain things have to be done, and I have a leap of faith in that I believe that the standards are there, and as long as we're doing projects that have something to do with groups like Ducks Unlimited, I think it'll be done right. So thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Would you reorient me as to who you are and what group you're?
Don McMillan, and I'm president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and we're alliance of most all of the hunting and conservation groups in Minnesota. We have about 55 individual groups and members. Now, I can go through the groups, not going to. But it's big groups like Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Deer Hunters, Turkeys, you name it.
Thank you. My question.
How many organizations are in the alliance?
About 40, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sharon.
My question is, I've had a lot of emails about this, and most of them really wanting to stay with the definitions that the Lessard Council has. There was one that was sort of an outlier of them, and I'd ask Senator Saxog about this, but I'd like to ask you. This particular question is an interest in not using funds for the purchase of land and an opposition to language that allows somehow the purchase of land, for these funds to be used for the purchase of land. Would you speak to what you think that's about and what your reaction is to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't know how you can get totally around not being able to purchase land. I mean, certainly we've done some things in northern Minnesota, forest legacy work, where land has been purchased and for a particular reason. And I think depending on where you're doing this, you may or not be purchasing land. I don't really have any problem with that. I don't think we have a problem with that. When land becomes available that would otherwise be developed and we would lose it as far as being able to recreate on it, do outdoor activities, I think that would be an appropriate thing.
Okay. Thank you.
Does someone else have their hand up? Okay. Mr. Lessard, do you want to come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I wanted to say goodbye. I see you, Senator. I'm going to be losing Senator Perso. Remember all the years that we were together? And where's Senator Fredrickson?
He's not leaving.
So anyway, Mr. Chairman, I was just thinking all the wars that we had together in all those years, and pretty soon I'll be coming from this committee. I won't know anybody. It's kind of getting kind of homesick. Senator Leroy Stump and I talked about that this morning. But having said that, I think I could have answered a lot of these questions, because I can tell you how it started and how these words were in here and why these words were put in here and how they were carefully drafted and how we went to the sportsman. In response to, when I first carried this bill, it was the 116th race, it was all over the place, and I couldn't get it through. I started out statutorily with this bill and trying to say what we were bringing in economically to the state of Minnesota, hunting and fishing and all the related products. The legislature said no, Senator Lessard. Senator Anderson, I think you remember some of the fights we had, arguments we had among this. I don't mean fights, but disagreements. And they were saying, well, Senator Lessard, what pot are you going to take it out of? Are you going to take it out of Health and Human Services? Are you going to take it out of education? Where? The LGAs? And then where does it stop? And that was an argument. So then what we did an add-on. Then the arguments became, well, Senator Lessard, what about all the other organizations that still get it? It went on and on and on and on. After I left the legislature, I think it was my very good friend Senator Anderson made a statement that she thought, well, you know, it's a pretty good idea, because they were trying to do stuff for clean water, which I really wanted to do. So they piggybacked on an idea or a concept that the sportsmen brought to the table. And then Parks and Arts got into it. And we all knew what happened then, all the friction, but we worked it all out. Now we go back and we pass the constitutional amendment. And that's why I, and I think every sports in this state group that we worked with, went out to sell it. Now we passed it. And now what's going on, and I don't think we all know what's going on, particularly with this amendment, or what's going on. They're letting us sportsmen, those of us that voted for it, swing in the wind. Because we've got the clean water, we've got the arts, and we've got the parks. And we have a system set up with the council to how the funding is going to go. Now they're trying to change the definitions. Now let me give you a little history on definitions. I was chairing this committee one time, and the other groups came in, and there's a big area in northern Minnesota, in Leroy Stump's district, and came a little bit in my district, out of Bedette. And I can't think of the name, Senator Stump. What is it, that big, what is it we call it?
Beltrami Island.
Well, it was that big, yeah, Beltrami County.
No, Beltrami Island.
Beltrami Island.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, it was that, that sea.
Lake Agassiz.
Yeah, that's what it was, Lake Agassiz. There was a snowmobile trail across there. And I said, there is no way that that's going to go through. That came from Badette, went over towards Bemidji. What happened at that point in time was the Nature Conservancy came to me, and they said, Son of Lassard, we will grandfather in that trail, scientific and natural area. Well, grandfathered in. I said, is that a promise? And they said, yes, it is. We passed it. The next year, because of that definition, groups came in to take that out. Now, I said, okay, if that's you want to play that game, we'll take off the whole thing. And to the Nature Conservancy's credit, to their credit, they came in and they kept their word. And that trail is still there. So what I'm saying is, by changing these definitions, restore, protect, enhance, were put there with very carefully crafted thought by myself and others. And that's why they were put in. And that's why we went out and told it to the sportsmen, here's what this is for. That's what they voted for. We're not touching the water fund. We're not touching the parks fund. We're not touching the arts fund. But we got a two-prong attack on what's happening. We're attacking through the definition portion of the bill, and we're attacking for the diversion of the money. That isn't what we voted for. I can tell you categorically, if this goes in and this diversion of this money goes through, there's going to be an uproar in northern Minnesota or out the state with our sportsmen's group. And that's what's going on here. And if anybody in this room doesn't feel that way, they believe in the tooth fairy, because that's what's going on. And I'm speaking to both this bill and Senator Chaudhry's bill that does all-inclusive, so I won't be back up here and preach on that bill. But I know I was in the trenches on this. I know one thing. We flew around the state. We sold it, restore, protect, and enhance. And I understand your question, sir, about I don't really know you, but I understand to do ecological system, of course we're going to do it. You don't have to spell it out. How far back in time that you do have to go. That's the way we should do things. But if you spell it out, I guarantee you there'll be lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit on every little project that's going to be done because you didn't go through this criteria. And that's what's going on. Now, if I sound a little bit emotional about this, I know how many years I worked to try to pass this thing. I knew what was in the bill, and I knew how I and other people in this room went out and supported it. Now, I understand that some will say, we didn't need you. I understand maybe they didn't need the sports. Maybe the Clean Water Group didn't need it. Maybe the Arts and Park didn't need it. But I suspect they did. And I think it's wrong, and I think that to leave us out there swinging in the wind right now, and we take that message back, I would really think that there'll be some people very much outraged. Now, it's up to this committee's to make the decision, and we'll abide by it. But let me give another example real quickly. I found out just the cities, as they expand, there's no place for kids to go. I hunted just every year, southern minutes, just south of the cities by Shakopee. Cities come in here, and the first thing they do, and they build up around it, and there's some little hunting area that comes in. You name one city in the metropolitan area or the suburbs that have come in and said, we will support hunting within your jurisdictions. You name one. There's an any. So people are going out to greater Minnesota. And I want to tell you this. This isn't for Bob Lassard. It's not for anybody in this room. It's for the kids. It's to leave a legacy of hunting and fishing for the kids. This section of the bill was made for hunting and fishing. And I'll make no apologies for that. Now, having said that, thank you very much. Now you've got any questions, I'll answer them.
Can argue.
I thought that was very well put. Senator Kielash.
Chairman, Senator Lassard, one of the things that I'm struggling with this legislation, and I want to say the assumption of the Lassard Group, is that what they say should be automatically rubber stamped by the Senate. Now, as a past senator, an outside group or someone, a group that's going to come to the legislature that needs to get approved funding, should not the legislature have some way of putting a stamp on it without the hunters and fishermen or the group that originally did it created the list of things that are going to be funded, getting all upset about it. Quite frankly, you know, there's a lot of us, a lot of the money that's going into this Lessard Fund is coming out of the metro area. I represent a metro district. There are several things that are included in this bill in the Heritage Wildlife Center that says we're talking about more than just game. And so my concern is that the Lessard Group is going to, and the Outdoor Heritage Group are going to come and say, we have to do this year after year, and this is what we've decided, and therefore this Senate should just automatically pass what we've discussed and decided on.
Chairman.
And as a senator, I find that, I'm sure you probably do, but that's the way I see it.
Mr. Chairman.
Coming out of the group.
Senator Clash, I respect that opinion, and I respect, but this is the way it was sold. If there's something in the metropolitan area that we can work with, that's fine. But this is why this, I don't think this amendment would have been here if we wouldn't have used the restore, protect, enhance for fish, game, and wildlife. That's how it was sold. Now, I go back to the argument, shall the legislature tinkle with what comes out of, whether you call it Lessard, Sam's, whatever you call it. I'm not here for my name. Believe me. The legislature, you have a council set up, which I think have done a very good job, by the way, to allocate the money after listening to all the different projects. And it is taxpayers' money. But I want to point out, you know, we do have, all you have to do on deer season is look at the taillights leaving town out of the Twin Cities. And we do have a lot of metropolitan Twin City hunters. In fact, in our seven-county metropolitan area, I'd like to know the DNR, have their opinion here. But I'll bet you out of our 475,000 hunters in our seven-county metropolitan area, I would suspect we must have, 125,000. You know, I'm just taking a guess on that. Mm-hmm. And I understand where you're coming from, but I feel very strongly that the legislature should leave the council alone, adopt those provisions, and then if it may end up being a court case. We may be heading for a court case on what? And I know some people are just looking for that. If it comes to that, it comes to that. But this is where the money should be spent for. Now, if there's something that makes sense and they work with the council without trying to put these definitions in, it should be done. I mean, there's ways that you can look at this and say, you know, this does kind of mean it, you know, that can be done. But if you put this verbiage in here and you spell out what invariably happens is the lawsuits. Because somebody says, well, you do ecologically, you didn't do this, you didn't do this, and you didn't go through those hoops. But I appreciate your concern.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair. To turn this around, just to state the dilemma, if the arts funding were coming to you and you had objections because it was all focused in the metro area and nothing was going into your district, you would probably want to say, wait a minute, that arts group shouldn't have this rubber stamp on everything being spent in the state. That's my issue with it. I think that one of the things that the outdoor heritage is not just game. It is wildlife. It is a natural habitat for wildlife. And wildlife does not just include game. It includes other species. And the metro area, when you talk about things being threatened as far as natural preserves and things, has far more things being threatened than that. And the other thing is the metro area does fishing. We have lots of lakes that could use a lot of help, and I think it's being ignored as well. I mean, we may not be able to do the shooting because we have citizens living in the houses across the street from open parks, but we do have fishing, and we also have a lot of wildlife in both in our natural parks and in our natural wildlife refuge, etc.
But so, Mr. Chair, the bill is what it is. It's a deletion bill, and I would just sooner we deal with what's on the. I mean, this has been a good discussion.
The bill deals with how to restore, protect, and enhance the distribution of the funding. Your point is well taken, Senator Kielash.
I appreciate your comments, Senator Sachs. I can see you're right.
And I'll just respond. And I do on fishery stuff, Senator Kielash. Absolutely. We have, you know, this money, the hunting gets lost in the thing, but the fisheries that we can do. And there's all kinds. I got a project that we can do within the metropolitan area on fisheries that certainly fit in the definitions. I see these when I go to work for, when I was living over here and I've kept the same place, and I see a lot of, you know, little minorities. And when I go, coming all the years, I was in the Capitol, and those little kids got no place to go. They don't have fishing piers, they don't have anything. And that all fits under the definition of the, what the council can do within the Twin City area. I want to point that out. I'm sure the council would back me on that one. But I appreciate talking to you. I really
thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we've gotten off track here a little bit about how we feel about what we feel about where the money should be spent. And we've spent countless hours in the Lessard Committee talking about whether hunting and fishing dollars should be spent in the metro versus the rural. And I think we've got a pretty good feeling there with the council, and I sit on that. What we got to remember here is that last year, to Senator Kelosh's point, last year this bill left the Senate 67-0 and went to the House. We all agreed upon the original language that came out of the Lessard group. We all thought it was good then. It got over to the House, and all of a sudden the brakes came on. I'm not understanding why quite to this day yet. But the bottom line is we as a group did vote to put that forward, and that was a real good, I think that made the Lessard group, at least I can speak for myself, feel real good that we had the support of the Senate then, and I would like to see it stay the same, and the definitions, as the former senator so eloquently gave us the history here, were put in there for a reason, and for whatever reason, we ended up in a conference committee that lasted hours upon hours. I don't have to tell the guys that were on the committee that. They did a lot of hard work, and there was some compromising. But I don't think we can compromise with this. I really don't. I think we have to say this is enough is enough. We have to go with the definitions the way they are.
Senator Anderson, and however you'd like to proceed with your amendment, we can certainly do that at this time.
And, Mr. Chair, are we done with the testimony?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, good.
And if you have
yes.
people who'd like to speak to your amendment,
no.
we could take those as well.
Not at all. No, I just want to speak to it now. And, Mr. Chair, this has been a really interesting process of trying to find compromise. And, you know, it's funny because in the public debate, people are always criticizing elected officials for being too partisan and not working together, and I agree with that. I think we need to try to work conflicts out, and that was the spirit in which I proposed this, and I'm not feeling like I'm making much headway. And from given the testimony that we're hearing today, I think people are digging their heels in deeper than ever, and I find that very distressing. And so I'm going to start by giving a little lecture. And I'm mom, and I give lectures a lot to my boys, because sometimes, you know, I think people need to. Senator Lessard, I have a lot of respect for you, and you and I have debated each other for decades, and I still love you, but I don't always agree with you, and you don't always agree with me, and that's fine. But I think it's important to respect what the sportsmen did to get this amendment passed, and I have a great deal of respect for that. But I also want to recognize, Senator Lessard, you're not speaking for 1.6 million Minnesotans who voted for this. They don't all agree with you. And there's some people in the House that don't agree with you. And there's some scientists who don't agree with you. And, you know, I think we need to sort of move on a little bit. Ecosystems are not a dirty word. Go over to the University of Minnesota and talk to a scientist. That's part of science. And I don't think we should be in a position of saying that if we're for the sportsmen, then we're going to reject science. We don't want to be, I don't want to see that happen. But that's what I'm hearing. And I want to say that I think probably most, I can't speak for everyone on this committee, but I agree with Senators Saxhog and Chaudhry that we need to get rid of the language that was passed last year. I don't think it works. I just don't think it's right. It's not the right language. But it's in law right now. And so what I'm trying to suggest is let's recognize reality. And reality is that not everybody agrees with you And some of them chair committees in the House of Representatives. And so Senator Saxog, when he goes to conference committee, he's going to need an idea. Because if he doesn't have an idea that provides a compromise, then guess what? We're going to be in the same place we are right now. And so I just want people to recognize reality and that sometimes you have to give a little bit. And so maybe I'll just stop there because that's enough of a lecture. And I think I will withdraw the amendment, not because I'm intimidated or because I think, you know, that it's the wrong thing to do. I think we need to be talking about finding common ground. I guess the other thing I would say about this amendment, you know, the beautiful thing about it passing is that it did allow all these Minnesotans to find common ground, sportsmen and tree huggers and everyone in between. And my constituents include all of those people. And they voted for clean water. They voted for a lot of things. But it wasn't just for what you believe, Senator Lessard. And we need to keep that coalition strong. And I think some people seem to thrive on dividing us, and I don't believe in that. I think it's wrong. So I just want to say that. So I'll withdraw the amendment, and I'm going to give it to Senator Saxog because he's going to need it later in the conference committee. And I hope people will start talking about how we're going to get something done here that's productive and positive. And I'll leave it at that. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxog.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Senator Anderson, and I certainly agree with you on the dynamics of how you get together with the House when the House has got a position and we have a different position. But, you know, the one thing that I got to say is that, and it kind of came to light when Ryan Bronson was doing his testimony for joining the Lessard Sam's Council, and I just going to paraphrase what I thought he said, and somebody can disagree with me, but I think he said this. I think he said, you know, I really agree with the definitions as they are, as the Lessard Council put them together. But what the real thing that we got to remember here is the work that the Lessard Sam's Council did last year and what I've heard is some very fine recommendations for this year. And so the job that's been done and what's been accomplished is kind of more important than what we're talking about in definitions. I'm glad that we didn't, God bless the House, that the House didn't decide to define exactly how we were going to pick people to be on the council, because that would have been something that we spent a lot of time on too. It just happened. It just went very well, and they did their and have been doing their work very well. So, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is move that Senate File 2691 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor, and I'd like to. In the case of this bill, see if we can match it up over in the House and sit down and see if we can come to some agreement.
Okay. We have a motion. Who's the House author?
You know, that's not for sure yet. So I.
All right. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Senator Chaudhry, you have a bill that is essentially the same with this, with the exception of subdivision C. Or how are we going to be dealing with that if we're voting on this now?
My thought, and I'm open to suggestions from the committee, is to pass both bills.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think that's a good idea, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Now we have Senate File 2830 before us as well. Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you be kind enough to move it?
I would.
And if everyone, just for everyone to clarify what the difference is, my bill 2830 also has the repeal of the legislative guide in it, but other than that, it's the same as Senator Saxog's bill. And I just wanted to make two brief comments. When we came up with the council, and determining its makeup and its functions. Legislators from both sides of the aisle and both the House and the Senate sat in the same room and talked it over. And that's how we arrived in creating the council. That was not the case with the definitions or the legislative guide. Not only that, but in my view, I've yet to see any science in support, and certainly in this committee, no one has stepped forward and given any reasons why the definitions that were adopted last session should be remain in place for any scientific or conservation value. In fact, we've heard quite the opposite. Something occurred to me when Senator Kelash was talking about the rural metro issue. I represent an entirely metro area as well, and I would like to see more land, public land, acquired and restored and enhanced in the metro area as well. Particularly, I want to be as close as possible to it, so I'd like it in my area too. But if we were required in Anoka County, southern Anoka County, northern Anoka County, Ramsey County, to enhance a parcel to the highest quality ecological value, that would be near impossible. We can restore parcels to nice grasslands, wetlands, but we cannot come even close to pre-settlement or even near post-settlement times. That's what a total high-quality ecological value is. We would not be able to do that with that standard. And so I fear that with the current definitions, if they continue to be pushed in statute, the ones that are in statute, it would leave out the metro area and leave out the opportunity, as the DNR testified, to have different types of conservation practices that have high ecological value, that have habitat restoration, that have recreational value, and all of that. And high quality ecological value could also exclude access to that land, which is in direct conflict with the Constitution as well. And that's what Senator Lassard was referring to in part when he was talking about lawsuit after lawsuit. That's why I think it's important that we repeal these definitions. I also agree that with Senator Kelash that we should, in the legislature, not be rubber stamping what the Lassard Council or any other council comes up with, because we do in statute have a process for approving those appropriations. But I think we should change the recommendations when we see true deficiencies in the work they have done. And I have yet to hear from anyone state what deficiencies, either process or scientific, that the Lassard Council or any other group has made to these outdoor legacy recommendations. So when we see those and hear and are explained to us why there are deficiencies in these practices, then we should review them and debate them, but not in the arbitrary way as has been done in with regards to the legislative guide and the definitions. Those are just my points of view. Discussion on the Ingebrigtsen motion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion
no.
prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Saxog. Do you want to stay there and take your 2821?
Yeah, I would.
And then we'll take Senator Kubley next.
Mr. Chair.
Senate File 2821.
I do have the A2 amendment that I would like to offer to get the bill in the shape I desire. It's an A2 amendment.
We'll pass that out.
Thank you.
This will be a delete all to your bill?
Yes.
Okay. I see no reason why we can't vote on the author's amendment now. On the 8-2, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. So now the A2 is the bill.
Yes.
Mr. Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2821, as amended, is a bill dealing with some ATV provisions. The first part of the bill deals with clarifying when a person can use an ATV during deer hunting season. The remaining sections of the bill change some of the provisions related to youth operation of an ATV. With me today is Jonathan Bowen from ATVMAM to give brief testimony to the language and help answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Jonathan Bowen. I represent the All Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota, as well as the Amateur Rider Motorcycle Riders Association. What we have here today are just some, we're codifying one piece of language that was passed a couple years ago and clarifying a couple of youthful operations and the non-resident trail pass that we passed last year. I'll just go through the bill real quick and explain what it does. The first part, Section 1, in 2007, with the work of Senator Chaudhry in this committee, there was a law passed that said the commissioner shall prescribe seasons for OHV use on state forest lands. What we would like to do is take what the commissioner had prescribed after that and codify it into law. This closes down the forest to recreational riding during deer rifle season. Our group agrees with this proposal and would like to advocate for it and have it in statute so that it is there for the future. The second part is OHM youthful non-resident operation. If you go to page 2 on line 2.5 to 2.8, this section allows for non-residents under the age of 16 to do a safety course that is designed by the Motorcycle Safety Foundation. Motorcycle Safety Foundation is the same organization that the State Patrol uses for their on-road safety training courses. They have a youth-specific OHM training course that they offer. So what we would like to do here is add that into statute so that a non-resident youth has the opportunity to do a training program in their own state, and when they come on vacation here or come to visit family, they can ride legally without having to take the Minnesota course. Also, a second part of that is on line 2.8, it adds or another state as provided in section 84.791, subdivision 4. That part of statute is a reciprocity agreement that we have with other states where the DNR can actually adopt their safety training program as sufficient to meet the requirements set out for our own safety training. On line 2.23 of section 3, we're deleting the words on another all-terrain vehicle. This is simply because we have certain people who ride ATVs or ride OHMs, and they accompany their children, whether it's on an OHM or it's on an ATV, shouldn't matter, just as long as they're accompanying their kids while riding. The next part on page 3, at page 3, line 3.9 to 3.17, this does... As I described before with the OHM youthful operation, it does about the same thing, only it does it allows for training on the ATV Safety Institute. The ATV Safety Institute is an organization that was created by all the manufacturers to enhance training opportunities for kids for responsible riding. And we are, our organization has checked out their safety program and said that it meets all the basic requirements. If someone were visiting, they can ride legally here. And then it also has the reciprocity clause as listed on line 3.14 to 3.15. Currently, there is no reciprocity with any other state's training programs. We're hoping that this gets that going a little bit so that DNR does go through and verify which other states have youth safety training and which one of those states will meet our requirements. The last part on page 4, lines 4.6 to 4.7, is simply allowing non-residents to operate an all-terrain vehicle that is registered in the state without having to have a non-resident trail pass. We passed language last year where a non-resident has to buy a trail pass if they're coming into the state to ride. but our intention was not to exclude them if they're visiting without a machine and riding a machine that's currently registered here. So our goal is for non-residents to have either a non-resident trail pass or be on a machine that is currently registered in the state.
So you only want the riding season be restricted during deer hunting and no other time?
Right. Currently, the commissioner has the ability, by commissioner's order, to close trails that are deemed unrideable. If they're wet in the spring or if there are other problems having to deal with environmental issues, the commissioner does have the ability to close specific trails for that purpose. And so this seasonal restriction, the original language was brought up because of a couple OHM riders who were operating in the Nemadji Forest during deer hunting season. And this will take care of any problems that have to do with riding during deer hunting season, but the commissioner still has the opportunity or the ability to close trails all over the state as he sees fit.
But isn't 1.4, 1.5 taking away that ability?
No. Mr. Chairman, no.
Says the commissioner shall prescribe seasons for off-highway vehicle use on state forest lands. And then you're crossing that out.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and what we're doing is, what we're trying to do anyway, is codify the season or the seasonal restriction into statute.
So where does it say that they can establish a season? Where is that codified? Because currently they generally have been opening the season up middle of May early May, and then closing it in the late fall. And I agree with your deer hunting season proposal, but that strike-through language would take away those seasons that the DNR has been working with.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, the season that the DNR commissioner has been working with have not been because of this language. The season that was created out of this language was, and this language that's in this bill is from the commissioner's order, the season that was created was shutting us down during rifle season. As I understand it, the commissioner's ability to close down trails and open up trails statewide is in another statute. And I don't think that that's taken away with this strike-through language.
Yeah, that's the periodic, during the season. If it's the trail is too wet, then they can close it.
Right.
But the general season that they started to create as a result of this language was the early May. And I can't remember where it ended. Well, let's hear from the DNR on that. And I guess I had another question, but I think that's for the DNR, too. Do you have any other witnesses, Senator Saxaud?
No. Okay. We'll just hear from the DNR, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Department want to comment? To the committee, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Major Rodman Smith, DNR Enforcement Operations Manager for the Division of Enforcement. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I was actually busily looking through here to find out the latest question you had, and I'm not able to find it right at this moment. I guess we haven't had a chance to look at that as much. As far as the rest of the bill goes, sir, and we can answer that question for you shortly if I can look through that. We did work through this with the author and did offer a few technical changes with the reciprocity for the other states, and we're fine with the reciprocity agreement language that was put in there.
Mr. Chairman, if I could speak briefly to your question. The original process that was created after this language was passed did include different seasons that started in May and ended in sometime in October, November. But the final decision was made to have the season be close us down for recreation riding during rifle season. And that's what the commissioner's order said, and that's where this language comes from. So the commissioner never ordered any closings or full season, but there were discussions of that at the beginning of the process.
Mr. Potter here, or Mr. Bowe? Oh, this is permissive language, and I'd still like that to remain in there. I think that's important. I like what you're doing and with the other codification. And I don't know, Mr. Smith, if you know, and I think the new language is just following current statute, but what does it mean to operate an off-highway vehicle on public lands or waters?
Mr. Chair, that would include frozen waters, I believe. What section are you
Throughout the entire section of statute that we're talking about, it references, whenever it says public lands, it says also includes or waters. And I don't understand where one would operate an OHV on public waters. I guess if it's frozen, right. I guess that would count, but I wonder if we should clarify that that's what we mean somehow. Mr. Knopf, did you have a thought?
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, there is a prohibition on operating an off-highway vehicle in unfrozen public waters right
okay.
now. what this does is it basically picks up anything that the DNR would manage, all the public lands and public waters in the state. It's usually written broadly like that.
Right.
But there is still a prohibition on doing that anyways, on unfrozen public waters.
Do we need to just clarify and insert frozen?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson?
I don't think we want ATVs being driven in lakes and streams, specifically prohibited from doing that because of the damage they do to the waters, to the aquatic life.
And as Mr. Knopf said, I think in other areas of the law, we already prohibit that. But on a plain reading, it may be confusing in this area of law that maybe we do allow it. Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, you could do that, but you'd have to amend a lot of other statutes than this one because it's littered throughout the statutes where we usually refer to public lands and waters. To do it here would then imply someplace else that you could. you could almost make it work. That would take, a fairly significant amendment to all of those sections of statutes that refer to off-highway vehicles and refer to waters. You'd have to put in frozen waters basically throughout. And that would be the way to do it. I don't know if you'd want to do it here in this bill, though.
Mr. Chair, is there any,
Logan?
Or Mr. Knopf, is there any place where water is defined so we could just change the definition to frozen and that would apply? Or?
Except that these laws apply to a lot of different things. And public waters are a defined term, but you wouldn't want to define them differently. It's a very broad term.
Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, I just don't think we should go there because even on frozen waters, you might be destroying vegetation on the perimeter of the lake, and that's vegetation for songbirds and animals.
Does the committee disagree that we should, maybe not now, but see about addressing this somehow, this question? Does anyone in the committee think it's okay in some instances to use OHVs on public waters, wetlands, or anything? Are there instances
frozen?
where we want that?
Mr. Chairman, you mean apart from being frozen?
Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little concerned that you'd be going down a path that you don't want to go down. For example, if you look on the amendment, on the A2 amendment, if you look at 1.9 to 1.20, this says a person less than 16 years of age operating on public lands or waters must possess an off-highway motorcycle safety certificate. If you put in frozen waters there, it would almost imply that they could ride it without the certificate on unfrozen waters, and I don't think you want to go there.
All right. Well, I raised that question, and maybe we can figure it out.
Mr. Chairman, because we do have a prohibition in other areas that says you cannot ride them on unfrozen public waters. No one can, regardless of when.
I'm just wondering if someone from out of state comes in and reads this rules on youth operators, they see public waters, they say it's okay. Well, maybe we can figure it out. Maybe not with this bill. Sarah Sieben?
Mr. Chair, wouldn't it work just to delete the phrase on public lands or waters so that obviously it would still apply that they may operate off-highway vehicles wherever they're allowed to? So just in this language, just take out that reference to on public lands or waters.
Well, what Mr. Knopf is saying is that there's a web of statutes that are all interconnected.
I know,
maybe
but
that's
isn't,
a suggestion.
But
we
my
can
suggestion
take,
for yeah. this, if you want to just get at these non-residents, is just make it consistent what it is for in other areas of the statute.
Well, Mr. Chairman, no. Senator Sieben, that would also though expand it then to private lands and that sort of thing. And we don't require registration for private lands.
Let's think about this. I think we know what the question is, and it sounds like the verbiage is just something that needs to be worked through. Mr. Bohn?
Mr. Chairman, I asked the same question to the reviser when I originally got the bill back after its first draft, and she stated this along the same lines of Greg Knopf, that there's just consistency in the statutes throughout and that it did need to be in there.
Okay. All right, maybe we can figure this out somehow. It sounds like almost a codification issue. Is there further discussion, Senator Saxog, about the 1.4 and 1.5? How do you feel about reinserting the stricken language? Permissive.
Here.
It's the reinstate this language. So on strike.
So what do you think?
Mr. Chair, we would be fine with that.
I appreciate that. This was a essential component to a compromise two years ago. So,
Chairman, I would move to reinstate the stricken language on lines 4 and 5, page 1.
All right. On Senator Frederick's motion on 1.4 and 1.5 to reinsert the stricken language after the letter A.
Mr. Chairman, do you not want to have the language in 1.7? The issue is the commissioner for season, and that would also apply to the ones established by the commissioner that might be different than the one that you have in here that would be codified.
Right.
What I'd recommend if you want to reinstate where you kind of were before would be to reinstate all the stricken language on 1.4, 1.5, and 1.7. And then what I would do is after lands, I would insert a colon 1 and then with parentheses, and then after paragraph, insert a semicolon 2 with the parentheses around the 2. So you would have, so basically, you're making it illegal to operate outside of the seasons prescribed under this paragraph, or during the firearm deer season, so that it would be, you would pick up both of those.
That sound okay?
Please incorporate that, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Frederickson has incorporated that recommendation from counsel. Discussion? None. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on Senate File 2821.
Mr. Chair, I have the A4 amendment.
Is that out?
Is this the same amendment?
Yeah.
I didn't know that you could
make it.
No, no one told me that.
You don't even have his job.
Thank you. That's what
I'm saying. I
didn't have a long time ago. You didn't still have it.
Which blue is that? A different bill, aren't you?
I'm just I gotta go out of here. I gotta get out of here in a little bit, so I'm just kind of.
Okay, well, first we're gonna put a.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment basically gets down to 1.13, and it says, that a person under 12 years of age may operate an all-terrain vehicle in an organized contest on public lands or water if the capacity is less than 90 cc's and the person complies with section 84.9256. Where this idea comes from, of course, is that snowmobiles and dirt bikes are already legal for people under 12, less than 90 cc to ride. So it would just add this particular mode of transportation for organized contests onto that.
Okay. Mr. Bone, did you want to speak to this?
Mr. Chairman, the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota was made aware of this amendment yesterday morning.
Oh, okay.
It's not coming from us.
Okay.
We did work with the author of the amendment and added the line about the person being supervised by an adult. And with that language, we were okay with it.
Mr. Meyer on the A4?
Mr. Chair, we're comfortable with the language. The supervision was our main concern in allowing this in a sanctioned event. Actually, if you look at that 84.9256 sub 1, let's get back to that section.
Awesome.
The exemption there, that as long as you're complying with that, I don't have that actual section with me, but the supervision by an 18-year-old or older was what we were concerned about, making sure that they are accompanied or supervised is making they're there with this person. It's a recruitment opportunity, allow a person to enjoy in an event that would be there.
Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sexhog, is there any limit to how young they can be? It says under age 12. So can my 2-year-old grandchild do this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I don't know that there is.
Mr. Knopf?
But and in fact, Senator Dill, I don't know if there is on under snowmobiles or dirt bikes either. So.
Mr. Knopf. Chairman, Senator Dill, there is a restriction. The one that Mr. Meyer is looking for is actually in the bill itself. If you look on the restriction in paragraph H that you see on 1.16 of the amendment, if you look on page 3 of the bill, 3.5 to 3.8, a person under the age of 16 may not operate an all-terrain vehicle on public lands or waters or on state granite trails if the person cannot properly reach and control the handlebars and reach the foot pegs while sitting upright on the seat of the all-terrain vehicle. So there are restrictions on being able to reach. But not on age. It's my understanding that for off-highway motorcycles, we're actually looser than that. In fact, even outside of contests, if you're supervising your child and you have a 2-year-old on an off-highway motorcycle, they could ride the off-highway motorcycle as long as you're accompanying them. So if this is not, this was narrowly drafted only to contests. It is a little bit of a disparity between the off-highway motorcycles and ATVs as far as who can ride them where. Apparently, currently right now, if it's an off-highway motorcycle contest, kids under the age of 10 could still participate in that off-highway motorcycle contest, but not in the ATV contest if it's on public lands because of the current restrictions that we have for ATVs.
Senator Stump, did you add your hand up?
Sorry.
No, I didn't. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stevens.
When I was just looking at the language on page 3, I also see that subdivision F says that a person at least 10 but under 12 may operate an ATV. And it looks like the same things if accompanied by a parent or legal guardian.
Right.
So I guess, are you looking to Are you trying to get rid of that, too, or keep that? Because it seems a little bit inconsistent.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, what this amendment does is it's currently, because of this provision, you can go below 12 years old for these contests. You can somebody 10 years old or older can ride in a contest. But what this does is allows them, those that are younger than 10, to be in a contest on public lands and waters. If it's on private land, it'd be any age. There's no age restriction in state law. But if it's on public land, under 10 years old, you would not be able to participate in a contest. And apparently there are contests where there are 5-year-olds and things like that that operate these things, these smaller machines in these contests. And what the amendment is trying to do is not to go below 10 years old for everything, like we have with off-highway motorcycles, but to just to narrowly craft it to only those contests, those official contests.
Chris Thumb.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, it's still a whole lot safer than hockey.
On the A4 amendment, Senator Olson.
Just a technical one. All the way through, it's talking about public lands or waters. On 115, you probably should make that waters plural, too.
Okay. Do you want to just incorporate that?
Yeah.
Right. Further discussion? Seeing none on the A4, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senate file 2821. Senator Olson.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, and then a technical, the same thing. Most commonly, it seems to say public lands or waters, but there's a couple places, one in the amendment and one in the law, in the underlying one here that it says public lands and waters, public lands. Public, so which is the one that's most desirable?
It'd be and or.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's a really good question. Sometimes and or doesn't really matter whether you use one or the other.
It's or most of the time through it, but
yeah.
It's saying both. But on 311, there's an and. You probably could make it consistent as or, and on 221, there's an and. All the rest of them are or.
It's a good bill. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, if you want to fix that, we can do that. What were the line numbers again?
I can move that on page 221, delete and insert or, and on 311 in the new language, delete and insert or.
Everybody understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Further discussion on Senate file 2821. Seeing none, Senator Saxhog moved that Senate file 2821 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair, could we? It does have a slight fiscal impact. Oh, can we send it full finance? Okay.
So and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Senator Kubley. Welcome back. Sorry we had to cut you off the other day. We by way of refresher, we had your constituent talk about his sheep farm and the problems he was having with coyotes. Why don't you go ahead and explain the bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you did listen to Mr. Padula's testimony, and I know he appreciated that he was unable to return today. The bill comes from a request from, one of my counties this year, although three of them are favoring it. It deals, it would simply give counties the option of having another tool in the toolbox, so to speak, to deal with what they perceive to be a growing problem. It is supported by the Minnesota Farm Bureau, by Minnesota Farmers Union, the Minnesota Cattlemen's Association, and the Minnesota Association of Townships. The Township Association, Mr. Chair, would like to add a small verbal amendment, and Mr. Solem is here to explain why they would like to take part in the bill as well.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Solem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I received an email late last week after this bill was heard, the counterpart was heard in the House, asking if we couldn't get support for townships to have the same option, and I've spoken with Senator Kubley. He was fine with it. The House member is fine with it as well. The thought is that there are some areas where having this option locally might be more effective for the problem that's trying to be controlled. And so the amendment would be on line 1.6 and on 1.8 after the word county, just insert or town.
Is that what they're called, town boards?
For the purpose of statute, it would be town board, correct.
Okay.
So it's,
and then it,
we would
part,
ask.
Any part of the county or township?
No, just town.
For the purpose of statute, we
or
are
town.
Referred to just town.
Okay. This is the first stop of the bill, so that would be an author's amendment to get it in the shape that he desires. Senator Engelbrechtson, will you move that?
So I would.
Everyone understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and now it's adopted. Senator Kubley, anything more you wanted to explain about the bill?
Well, it's a fairly simple bill, Mr. Chair. I understand Senator Dale had an amendment that he would like as well. I have had a chance to look it over. I don't think it would be a problem.
Okay. Let's take the testimony on your bill, the rest of the testimony on the bill, and then we can get to amendments. Mr. Goldman, did you have any other witnesses, Senator?
Okay. Not today, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Goldman, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Howard Goldman. I'm the committee. I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. We have over 170,000 members and supporters in the state, and we oppose this bill. Bounties don't work, pure and simple. They were ended in 1961 in our neighbor North Dakota. They committed over $2 million, coyote, fox, and they concluded it didn't work, and consequently they ended the program. The same is true in Minnesota. Bounties began in the 1860s in Minnesota. They ended in 1965, after almost 100 years. Again, it was concluded they simply don't work, particularly with coyotes. Coyotes are very adaptable species, have a high reproductive rate. The population, if it begins to decline, they'll simply compensate with larger litters. It's been estimated by some biologists, wildlife biologists, you have to reduce the population by almost two-thirds in order to produce any long-term benefits. Coyotes' diet consists of small mammals, rabbits, mice, voles, skunks. They are opportunistic. They do take sheep on occasion, but it's not their principal food source, not even close. Coyotes, in addition, can be very beneficial to waterfowl. According to research conducted in North Dakota and in Minnesota, I believe, ground nesting birds have a much higher nesting success in areas where coyotes are the main predator and not fox. Coyotes prefer small mammals over birds. Coyotes in the state of Minnesota, as you all know, are unprotected, can be taken in unlimited numbers at virtually any time, all year round, under virtually any circumstances. Ron Shera, who I know was quoted on Monday during the hearing, has also written an article about coyotes, which I thought was right on point. And I should mention that Mr. Scherer is not a member of our organization or a supporter, and we have very little agreement with Mr. Scherer's views except on this issue. There may be one or two others. The title of his column is Coyote Bounties Are Bunk, and I just want to read a few sentences because I think, as I said, they're right on point. He states, a coyote bounty doesn't guarantee that the coyote killed for money is the same coyote who likes mutton. A bounty payment goes to the same hunter who is hunting coyotes for the sport of it and would continue coyote hunting if no bounty were offered. If only Swift and Yellow Medicine counties paid coyote bounties, the county commissioners would need a new four-lane road to handle the traffic as bounty hunters hauled coyote carcasses to the courthouse from at least three states. You want fraud? Establish a bounty. Hire a trapper to nail the guilty coyote, and we agree with that, is the best and most effective way to deal with these issues. And in conclusion, he says, roll down the window and throw out the tax money. And that basically summarizes our view as well. We urge you to vote against Senate File 2461. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair.
But Mr. Goldman, I appreciate the Humane Society of the United States endorsement of trapping.
I admit that's a bit ironic.
Sir Cooley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It does seem to me that some of Mr. Goldman's comments, by implication, seem to imply that coyote populations are controlled by the wildlife that lives in an area. I can assure you they are not. You know, their populations are currently too high, especially along the Minnesota River, and I would hope that the counties or townships would limit the areas where they could be taken from, and I know that's going to impose some of the problems that Mr. Goldman mentioned. But, you know, one of the DNR's own enforcement officers has told me that he thinks the populations are too high to be supported by the populations of wildlife in the range that they cover.
Okay. I'm sorry, did people have their hands up? I didn't. If you did, I didn't catch it. Okay. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, is this bill traveling alone, or is it going to become part of your omnibus bill?
It could be both.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, I had an amendment drafted on this subject to your omnibus bill, but since we're talking about it now, I'm wondering if we should deal with it with this bill.
Whichever you prefer.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, your amendment is to this bill with the number that's on it.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, it was redrafted to – I don't have copies of that bill with me or that amendment with me. I gave you a copy of that one, but it's the real one is the one that we're ready to do here with enough copies and so forth is to Senator Chaudhary's bill. But we could make it work to this one if
we –
Sure.
That's easy to do.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to have it passed out?
Okay. Is it passed out? Oh, I guess it's being passed out. Okay. Well – Mr. Chairman, members, I have raised, or my family's raised sheep since the 1930s, and I've had personally a lot of experience with predator attacks. And it's not just coyotes, but domestic dogs are a very significant problem. And I know how it works out there. I'm trying to make some adjustments to state law to coincide with what actually occurs out there, and it would be helpful to be able to do some of these things and still be within the law. Now, the first part of this bill has to do with the disposal of carcasses that are part of livestock production. And the current law requires you to bury or dispose of the carcass as soon as possible after death. Well, when you're dealing with a predator problem, it's often helpful to leave the carcass out on pasture or near the kill site to try to attract the offending predator back to that location so you can either trap it or shoot it. And so the first part of this amendment, if you look on page 2, lines 2.11, it says this paragraph does not apply to livestock killed by wild animals or domestic dogs and the carcass is out of sight of the public. We know the public would be disturbed to see dead animals in a pasture, but if they're pulled out of sight, they'll never know they're there. And I want to add some additional words to the amendment as is stated here. So at the end of on line 2.12, after public, if we could delete the sentence and add the words and
delete the sentence.
Delete the period. And then add the words as follows.
and will be used to attract the offending predator back to the kill site. Now, there's a couple of things that are going on here. One is that you have a dead animal out there that was killed by a predator, and if you remove the carcass immediately, you're taking away that food source, and so the other option is to kill another sheep. But if you leave the carcass there as a way of trying to attract them back, maybe you get a decent shot at them or set some traps, and you save some of your sheep from getting knocked down. So that's why I've got that there. Now, the second part of this amendment, starting on line 2.16, it says exception for livestock producers taking predators. The exception has to do with whether or not you can carry a loaded weapon in your vehicle. Now, we changed the law last year to allow us to carry a weapon without being in the case, but we're not allowing it to be loaded. So this allows for a loaded weapon to be carried in a pickup truck, for example. But I'm going to add a few words to this sentence also, and I'll just read it. The current words are, the restrictions in Subdivision 1 do not apply to a livestock producer while taking unprotected. I want to insert the word predatory between protected and wild. So it'll read unprotected, predatory, wild animals. And then after animals, add the word or predatory domestic dogs on the person's farm if the livestock producer is experiencing problems with wild animal or domestic dog predation on livestock. So what this does is there's just a very narrow group of people that can do this. You have to be a livestock producer to carry a loaded weapon in your vehicle. You have to have... It has to be on your own farm, and it has to be on a farm that is experiencing predation from dogs or wild animals. So it's just a very narrow slice of the general public that would be able to do this. And here's what the problem is. You've got dogs that come in and are killing your sheep. They hightail it off the spot, the place, out of the farmstead or through the pasture. And you're trying to intercept them maybe on the other side of a cornfield or on the other side of a woods, and it's just very unhandy to be trying to load and unload and follow all these rules. Now, last night, the dairy farmers had a reception at the Kelly Inn, and I talked to one farmer who told me that he had a pack of wild dogs that came onto his dairy farm and actually killed an adult cow. They ran her into some trees or some buildings or something where she couldn't get away, and they ate away at her. And they killed some young stock, and when they found out about it, they got in their pickup truck with a loaded weapon. The father was driving, and the son was there with a rifle, and they were going down the gravel road because they could see these dogs heading north, and they wanted to intercept them down there somewhere and take a shot at them. But the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service vehicle appeared on the same road, so they put the gun out of sight, and they were very thankful the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service didn't see this weapon in the pickup truck. But that's the way things work out there. It's just how it goes. You've got to. It's just very unhandy to be unloading and loading a weapon when you're trying to intercept these animals, and you never know when you're going to need a loaded weapon. So that's the other part of this. So I hope that the committee can see clear to put this in. Now, there's two things that I want to mention first. I did talk to Bob Meyer about this, and there may be a little bit of tweaking the DNR may want to do with it. And I did talk to the Board of Animal Health. Dr. Hartman is not in today, but Dr. Petrini was. And they haven't endorsed this yet, but they're looking at it, or will be looking at it. They haven't seen the full amendment yet. I just talked to them on the telephone about it.
Mr. Chair.
Coobley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dale, you know, my contact with sheep is not nearly as extensive as yours, but if you're trapping them, it seems to me that sheep are pretty curious about something new that shows up in their space. And if you'll forgive me, they're not terribly bright. You know, what's going to prevent them from being trapped how are you going to protect them from, you know, stepping into the same scenario set for the predator?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Coobley, you're identifying a problem. I'm not too really worried about the sheep getting caught, but I am worried about bald eagles descending on the carcass and getting caught. And so I don't think a leg hold trap is probably appropriate. Perhaps a snare is. But I think the best choice, if you've got some patience and can wait out there, is probably better to sit there and shoot the offending predator rather than go with a trapping option. And I've done both, but I have a lot of bald eagles on my farm, and I got very concerned that I might accidentally catch one. So I have pretty much discontinued using leg hold traps in that situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Dill, the other question I had was, what's to stop a livestock farmer from driving around the roads, and if he gets stopped with a loaded weapon, say, I have a problem with wild animals, predation on my farm, but he's really deer hunting from his car. How do we deal with that problem?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would look into his eyes. And I'm sure a trained attorney like you could probably detect whether or not.
Well, yeah. The eyes reveal much, don't they? So, but I think a trained I'm coming at it from a trained attorney's, eye is that, if I were to read this, I might be able to find a loophole for my client. So that was one question. I understand what you're trying to do. Is your intent to allow a farmer to be able to drive around within the confines of their own farm and shoot and have the loaded weapon? Is that your intent? Or do you want them to be able to go on roads as well? I suppose you have to go on roads sometimes to access
the
other side of your farm.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, there's a farmer in southeastern Minnesota that has 1,500 ewes. They lamb in May. They're all on pasture lambing. He has a lot of trouble with coyotes and other predators. And in his situation, I would expect he would probably want to have a loaded weapon in the back of his pickup truck ready, and he was spending a lot of time on his farm off country roads, but of course some of the time he's on country roads as well, but he's going from pasture to pasture checking sheep, and it'll be very handy for him to be able to use his firearm and have it ready. And his argument is, if you can walk down Main Street Minneapolis with a loaded handgun, why can't he carry a loaded rifle on his own farm? But there would be times when you may be on a township road or a public road to traveling from one pasture to the next or traveling from one end of the field to the other. I told a story about this last summer. I had a dog attack, and I had my rifle with me. It was in a case, but by the time I got it out of there and got some ammunition into it, the dogs had disappeared into this cornfield. So in that situation, I may want to drive to the other side of the cornfield and wait and see if something emerges from the cornfield, and then I'd be ready to take a shot at him.
Senator Dill, is it your intent to allow the person to shoot from the vehicle as well? Because that would be the fastest way of taking care of it. Or would, even though it's loaded, do you still envision them needing to step out and shoot as is currently required?
Well, I think the main objective is to render the predator dead. And I can imagine sometimes you may want to shoot from the vehicle, and sometimes you may want to get out and take a, rest the weapon on the hood of your car and take a decent shot at him.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stump?
Is there currently a law that prevents us from carrying a loaded vehicle or a loaded gun on your vehicle on your own land? What is it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, it's the law that this is providing an exception for. It said it's basically transportation of firearms. A person may not transport a firearm in a motor vehicle unless a firearm is unloaded in a case expressly made to contain a firearm and the case is fully enclosed as a firearm. And then last year, Senator Chaudhry's bill also does provide an exception to that when you're hunting, going between fields, things like that. But otherwise, you are prohibited. The only thing that you can – the other exception is that you can do the carry a handgun in compliance with the concealed carry law, but not any other firearm.
Why? I'm sure that law gets broken just about every day. And why would we want to prevent somebody who's got livestock from carrying a gun on an ATV or a pickup truck that probably is only licensed or isn't even licensed, you know, on their own land? I don't
particularly
see.
For
prime use.
Well, that's a huge policy question, but the question here is to be able to do that to take a predator.
Yeah.
And I don't. I'm not hearing except from Mr. Goldman. Well, he didn't testify on this amendment. Presuming he's against this too, but I don't think I'm not seeing disagreement with that. I think the question is how do we keep the any new rule from being abused for other reasons. For example, taking a deer. Well, there's a coyote, and oh, there's a deer some yards behind it. Since I'm having a coyote problem, I have the ability to shoot from my car. I'll take that deer as well. So that's, I think that's the one question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just, you know, I think the qualifiers could be, as Senator Dill mentioned, you have to have livestock. Because,
yes.
I mean, you have to have something for the for the depredation part of it. And then secondly, the period of time when you really are susceptible for depredation is during either the calving or lambing,
okay.
Which is a window of, you know, maybe a month or 6 weeks.
All right, you said something interesting that you said you should have something for the depredation. That's showing that there's some depredation going on.
Except be loaded.
Well,
now that would be an important if
sure.
that can be shown. We'll get that in a second. That would be that'd make a difference.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Kielash, and then
Scott. Yeah, Mr. Chair, since I've been corrected already today because I got off the subject of the bill in front of us, I just wanted to make that note here that we're really talking about a bounty bill, and we've gotten off into who can carry a gun in the fields and who can't. I'm not sure if we want to continue, but I think it needs more thought than what's come to the table because it involves so many more issues than just the bounty that on the coyotes.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just difficult with Senator Stumpf's comments. Farmers are a little more proactive, and they're going to try to prevent deprivation. They're not going to wait. If they see a coyote coming over the hill, they're preparing to eliminate said coyote.
Senator
Any way
Dill,
they can.
Senator
Any
Dill,
way
what,
they
do you,
can.
What do you think about taking these comments into consideration and
Mr. Chairman, members, I understand that it needs some more work, and that's part of what the committee process is about. The DNR has maybe an idea or two, maybe the Board of Animal Health has, and if we could move this on to the next committee, then we'll just keep working on it.
I don't think it's going to another committee. What is?
State and local.
Or does it have to go to state and local anyway?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, state and local is not going to deal with the firearm issue as much.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
It's whether to allow the county board.
Firearm should stay here.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that this amendment is inconsistent at all because the whole purpose of it isn't just the bounty. It's controlling a predatory animal.
I agree with the.
I agree with
the intent is consistent. Senator Dibble?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that I would normally support moving something on, but I know that Senator Rest is fairly stringent about the subjects that can come up in front of her committee and confines those discussions to her committee's jurisdiction. So fixing, if there's something to be fixed that relates to environment and natural resources, it probably needs to be done here.
Right, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, about your omnibus bill, are you going
to
move
this
that?
Would be appropriate to that.
So if I just – we've had the discussion now. Maybe I should just wait and give you a – okay.
And, if Senator Kubley and the committee desires, we can roll his bill into that in addition to moving this on.
And will your bill stay here for a few days yet, or is it leaving?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's do it that way.
Passing it out tonight.
Oh, because it has to.
Go test it out to the state.
It has to go to the state local. Well, I'm informed that we do have to pass it out tonight, but that doesn't mean that we can't continue working on it and amend it on the floor after some resolution is made, or even tonight.
So, Mr. Chairman, would you prefer that I withdraw this amendment and do it on your bill?
Kind of, yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll honor your kind of request, and I will withdraw the amendment for the time being.
Thank you. We understand where you're going with this. Just need to work out the details. Further discussion on Senate file 2641. Seeing none, Senator Scogin moves that Senate file 2641 as amended be... Was it amended?
Yes.
Yes, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion
no.
Prevails. All those opposed, sorry. Motion prevails. Okay. Anything else before we come back
Thank
tonight?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The committee will be in recess until 6 p.m. tonight. Thank you.